Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Small don't say,
self-help from the hip.
Small don't say,
we're talking that shit.
Small don't say,
and keeping it real.
Small don't say,
with me and them seals.
It's so funky.
First of all, I just, you have a smolder face that you made, there it is right there.
I've been told. Some people call it a smirk. Some people call it a smolder, you know. Can I tell you honestly where that comes from? Is that, you know, just being a Black woman, obviously everything about us is policed and weaponized.
Yeah.
And I'm a very, I'm a true Aquarius. So I'm very introspective, like very in my head. And so I would always have this furrowed brow, like I've had since I was a kid. Yes. And so as I was, you know, coming up as a city councilor and now in Congress, when people would take a photo, it would become like a permanent stock photo, me with this furrowed brow, and make it like I'm angry when I was just being like fully present in the event, you know, just affected by what I'm hearing. And so then I said, okay, well, I don't want to stand there and just smile, you know, right, just spontaneously. Right. You see people do that, right? When they
yes,
like an interview, and it's because
girl, I was on the reel. That's okay, how they, right, right, they face so on the reel.
Right. So people are being, you know, self-conscious and they're like, oh, I better, yep, you know, pop a smile or whatever. And so I didn't want to do that because I didn't feel authentically me unless I genuinely wanted to smile, you know? So I said, okay, what would be like an in-between thing I could do that's kind of, you know, warm and inviting, but like authentic. So I was like, I'm going to do a little half smile. And then that just became this smirk thing, but that was not my intention.
Like literally when they make merch of you all the time and pins and whatnot, like, you know, how RBG, they always had the, you yes, know, her fancy yes, collar. Yes, they're going to yes, give you the smolder. They're going to give you the
they
smolder.
They do. They do. Yeah, absolutely.
We are joined by, because we just got into it. We are joined by United States Representative.
Yeah.
United States Representative, Democrat of Maryland 7th District, Ms. Ayanna Pressley.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi.
We are very happy to have you because you are someone in politics that I like. And so we are very happy to have you because these days that is hard to come by. And I think so many people look to you as a beacon of light in what feels like a really dark, not feels like, in what is a really dark time. And when I say that, it's because I feel like you and, you know, there's a few other folks that are alongside you, Ilhan, for example, you say shit, you say shit, you do things, you feel like what I think a lot of us expect a public figure and an elected official to do, to represent mm-hmm, the people.
Yeah.
You know
Thank
what I mean?
Thank you so much. That's very humbling for you to say that. And I do want to say, albeit belatedly, a couple of years ago, you made my whole day. You may not remember this because you get asked to do these things all the time, like being on Cameo or something. People probably asked you to do that. But yeah, you recorded a birthday greeting for me that was a part of this big video yeah, my team did for me. And anyway, it just meant the world to me. I'm so appreciative of you. Your intellect and your wit are equally sharp. And also you have such a big platform and you have been such a responsible steward with that platform. And I just, you know, so appreciate that. So I appreciate you as an artist, as a creative, as a thought leader, as an author. Let's go.
Thank you.
You know, I do. So anyway,
thank you.
I just wanted to say all of that.
I I think I said Maryland. I meant to say Massachusetts. So let me just catch that real quick. I didn't pick up on it.
You know what? Actually, today, well, I won't timestamp things, but I was recently just doing some movement building work and campaigning for colleagues and competitive primaries, and Representative Omar, is one of them. And I realized when I looked at the stage, I said, okay, we have Massachusetts, we have Missouri and Representative Cori Bush.
Yes.
We have Michigan with Representative Tlaib, and then Minnesota. So, you know, however you want to get to that, you know, power of M.
Yes.
Come on, there's some exciting things afoot in Maryland potentially, you know, so, you know, you can throw that in the mix. But no, I'm the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, adopted home for me. I'm actually originally from Chicago. That's my roots are, you know, very Midwestern, which is why, you know, I bowl and drink black coffee and eat plain old fashioned donuts. and like my hot dogs grilled. So I'm, you know, very, very, very Midwestern in that way. But yeah, this is an adopted home for me. Came here to attend Boston University in 1992. And that really kind of completely changed the trajectory of my life. So yeah, definitely in the Massachusetts 7th. And
well, shout out to the Massachusetts 7th. Boston is always like, when are you coming to Boston? I'm like, yes. I was in Boston with Smart, Funny, and Black at the end of the year last year. But, you know, y'all are like Northeast, but not like, but like past New York. So
I know,
like
but there's some culture and some vibes.
It is.
Some shifts happening here. So
shout out to Dorchester.
Yeah. So keep us on your radar. Yeah.
Well, you know, I first want to just talk about the change you said that happened when you were at Boston University. Like, was the change you deciding like this was the course that going into, okay, so what was the change?
No, so the change was just being in the city of Boston. So I'm an only child, grew up in a single parented household.
Shout out to only children, single parent households.
OCOGs. And my father, you know, who's doing great now and has since retired, he went on to become a college professor and a published author, but for many of his years was in a cycle of substance use disorder. And then because this country believes in treating trauma with more trauma, he was incarcerated. And so, you know, our household was very destabilized and, you know, it took a while for things to sort of right size. But anyway, so that's sort of my, like a little bit of my origin story, kind of what shapes my worldview. And my mother was a super voter. She was a community builder. She was a tenants' rights organizer. And she taught me early on, there's this difference between like your job and your work. Like your job is what you do to pay the bills. And then your work with a capital W is the work of the upliftment and the betterment of community.
Yeah.
And she also told me, she modeled this and poured into me that to be Black is a beautiful thing and something I should be prideful of, but that I was being born into a struggle. And she had an expectation that I would do the work of Black liberation and the liberation of all marginalized people. So I was very civically engaged. I was, you know, president of my class, you know, a cheerleader, you know, albeit 60 pounds ago. I was a competitive debater, you know, a volunteer. So I was very civically engaged. Then I came to Boston University and I was president of my college and doing a number of leadership sort of things. And I got this internship and I worked 3 paid jobs through that unpaid internship. I want to say today that definitely would not stand. I'm grateful the congressman gave me that opportunity and that was more the status quo at the time. But now we pay our interns a living wage. And that's been nice. Really game changing throughout Congress to really in the Senate to diversify the pipeline, you know, because for a long time, those opportunities were only for the kids of donors.
Yeah.
So it's crazy because I was an intern in this office, the Massachusetts 8th at the time, and working 3 paid jobs for that. And then ultimately, he hired me and I worked for that congressman for 4.5 years. Then I worked for Senator Kerry for 11 years. And then I served on the city council for 8 years, and I've been in Congress for 4. So I'm going to lift that up because, listen, I wouldn't give short shrift to my magic. I definitely have that, but this is not just Black girl magic. This is a Black woman work. I've been putting it in. People think we just sort of like fell out the sky. And then, you know, I've been doing the work of movement building and electoral politics literally since I was in utero. And my very first campaign was at the age of 10 years old to help elect the first Black mayor in the city of Chicago. So I've been at this it's a long time. So, but Boston changed the trajectory of my life. It was attending Boston University and then landing that that internship.
Major. Because you're right. People absolutely feel like folks just pop up and decide like, okay, I'm about to run for office, because that's how it feels for so many of us who see politicians that are coming into this position with money behind them, right? It's just like, well, I had the money, so why didn't I just do this thing?
But also it's that, and you deal with this, you know, as a creative, as an artist, you know, as an actor, is that, you know, maybe there's some people that saw you on television for the first time and they said, oh, this is this, you know, incredibly talented, you know, beautiful up and coming talent. And you're like, up and coming.
Up and coming.
You're like, do you want to see the battle scars? Holy, I've been at this for a while, you know? So I think whatever it is that you do, people very rarely understand that it is an art form, that there is a science, that there is work that goes into that for decades. But, you know, this is work that I'm prepared to do for as long as there's breath in my body, because the work of justice seeking really is never ending. And progress is measured in decades. It's measured in years. It's not measured in days and weeks. You know, so if you want to do the work of liberation, truly, you know, buckle up, because that work just, it never ends.
How do you feel like in this current climate, you are supported in that work by your fellow Democrats?
Well, first, I would say that where I find what I'm fueled by, where I'm fortified, where I'm emboldened, is being in movement. Is being in movement, is being in community. And it's the power of that movement that has us closer than ever before to seeing student debt cancellation. Mm-hmm. It's the power of that movement that made Black maternal morbidity a part of the national discourse. It's the power of that movement that recently resulted in that victory in Kansas of Roe and abortion care, you know, on the ballot. So, you know, I find inspiration, I find strength in the movement. When it comes to the party, you know, listen, I'm a Democrat. That's all I've ever been. And we are a big tent, you know, party. I will say that the struggle for me is to be weaponized, mischaracterized, you know, boiled down to, in some instances, like a shallow, digestible soundbite that is not that does not center my humanity, that is not representative of the work that I've put in. I think when you are doing the work of resistance to injustice, when you are actively seeking to dismantle white supremacy, to undo the harm of decades of policy violence, you know, not everyone is going to love that. And so I just accept that this, I'm honoring the tradition of that Black women have played on the front lines of every social justice movement. We are truth tellers.
Yeah.
You know, we are table shakers. We are also coalition builders. You know, we are conveners. And, you know, that's not going to be easy. So I don't always feel understood. And I think to be misunderstood can be a very painful reality.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it can be a very painful reality. And I've just had to, accept that there may be people that never get it. And I just have to be okay with that, because I'm very clear about my why. I'm very clear about who I'm accountable to, who actually sent me to Washington. And again, I'm not new to this. You know, I have respect for that body, for the institution. I grew up in it. You know, I was an aide for 16 years before I was elected to my first office. So, you know, I'm not new to any of this. And I think that has given me the resilience to deal what sometimes can be just a very lonely walk.
Well, let me just pour into you and say that as someone who knows about the lonely walk, I hope that you know that even in your feelings of loneliness, which is a very real feeling, there are so many of us who really do look to you as an example of how we would love to see the Democratic Party exist in a much more grand form. And, you know, I feel like the energy and the effort that you are putting in on a daily basis to being not only action-oriented, but very vocal. And I think that's important because people will always say, oh, actions speak louder than words. Yes, but in a country where media is king, you also need the words, right? So you need the action, but then you also need to be verbalizing what's happening and what needs to happen because that's what people are hearing. That's what people are able to like receive. And the right wing side, and that's me being very generous, because the white supremacist Christian nationalist side of politics is very verbal in a way that's cacophonous. It's a noise that can silence the work that someone like you is doing. And it's so necessary that you continue to speak and we continue to lift you up and the folks that are speaking and working in the way you are, because those people are showing up every single day to oppress. They do not waste a day in figuring out how to continue to oppress. And I'm constantly just trying to empower us as folks who are challenging oppression to carry that same energy in challenging it. And I see that in you on a regular basis. And it does make me say, like, this is not a futile effort. Like, there are people in the mix who get it. And there's so much apathy that we're fighting right now. When you are doing your work, you know, I don't feel like the Republican Party has to consider engaging voters in the way that the Democrats have to at this point to make people feel like they're heard. How do you feel like you and also the party can help to ignite voters in a real, actualized way? Because the clock is ticking on midterms.
Mm-hmm. First of all, don't talk people out of their lived experience. Okay, so when you say, I wrote a bill or we passed a bill and someone says, okay, but I'm still struggling. Right. You know, I haven't felt the impact of that. We should not talk people out of their experience. Mm. I think sometimes we get into like a rote rhythm of just listing a litany of things that have been done,
yes,
but isn't centering. Because and a lot of it comes from a defensiveness, mm-hmm, in feeling that people don't always appreciate how much of our work is harm reduction. They don't know the things we stop from happening, while also being at a parallel track of actively seeking to advance things. I'll just say that about myself. I'm, mm-hmm, doing both harm reduction, dismantling, and also, you know, seeking to advance things. I say policy is my love language because we've legislated hurt and harm. We can legislate equity. We can legislate healing. We can legislate justice. And that's what I seek to do, and to do that in a way that's intersectional, because that's how we live. We don't live in big check boxes. Right. You know, all of these things are connected. We live in intersectionality, complexity, nuance, right? Mm-hmm. Shout out to Kimberly Crenshaw. So we live in, yes, we live in that intersectionality. And so I think there's a defensiveness that many elected officials feel, yeah, in trying to make the case for like, no, I am trying, I am working. So they just start giving you like a resume. And people are like, okay, I hear that. Some of it I understand, some of it I don't, but regardless, I'm still struggling. And we have to center that, be real. Don't talk people out of their struggle. You can let them know you're fighting for them, but you need to actively listen. The other thing is we have to have a paradigm shift, a politics of transformation, not of transaction. One of the things that we do in our organization is what we call deep canvassing work. It's like really the work of deep democracy, which is we are canvassing and we are knocking doors year round, not just for an election cycle. And we're knocking doors not to say, are you gonna vote for me or not? You know, we're engaged in conversation. We're asking, what are your needs? Are your basic needs being met? Do you know about student debt cancellation? That was one of the issues we went on doors with in the middle of the pandemic, talking to people about, and we were able to move the dial on that. There was a lot, right, of harmful mischaracterizations, false narratives about the issue of student debt cancellation. Mm. So many thought it was really a minority of people impacted. They thought student debt cancellation was would be regressive in impact. They didn't think it should be a top priority. But after we engage in these conversations, many people moved, or they thought about the issue differently, even if their position stayed the same.
Right.
And so we have to do a politic of transformation, not just transaction. Before you ask someone for their vote, you need to ask them about their lives.
Yeah.
You need to understand their worldview, sort of how they arrive at these things. And the other thing is, I really believe in governing cooperatively. And so if you govern cooperatively, I always say the people closest to the pain should be closest to the power, driving and informing the policymaking. When you are developing legislation in partnership with those closest to the pain, then they feel that what you're doing is responsive, right?
Yes.
So at the end of the day, people just need to feel the impact. When we had the child tax credit, people felt that impact. We had stimulus checks, people felt that impact. You could debate, is it enough? Could we use more? But they felt the impact. When we extended and expanded unemployment, you know, during COVID relief packages, people felt that impact. You know, so I think ultimately, in order for us to be successful, it's about doing the work of engagement, mobilization, and movement building all the time, not just for a cycle. It's advancing responsive, bold, transformative legislation that people feel the impact of. And we have to be willing to put our bodies on the line. You know, Amanda.
Say it. Say
Amanda, but the thing is that Amanda, you'll co-sign that. But guess what? We have people, and I'm talking even within the progressive flank, people who were critical of us sleeping on the steps of the Capitol, led by Representative Cori Bush, in the midst of the eviction moratorium.
Who has done the podcast, Dr. Cori.
Expiring. Yeah, shout out. That's my sister. We had people that were critical of us protesting and getting arrested or detained on the steps of the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court is extremist and far right, legislating from the bench, completely unprecedented, overturning the will of the people. And, you know, abortion care is health care, reproductive justice, maternal justice. You know, these are life and death issues. And so people were critical of that. And
they'll say
it's performative and, you know, it's attention seeking. And you know what, Amanda? If that's all we did, then maybe I'd hold some space for your cynicism. That can't be the only thing we do.
Correct.
Your city councilor, your state rep, your state senator, your mayor, they need to be legislating. They need to be codifying the value of your life in every budget. All of that needs to happen. And if they're not getting it done, you want to see them go down fighting. And that means using every single lever. I use every lever, the power of my letterhead, the power of my pen, the power of my platform, the power of the movement. You know, you have to do all of it. This time it demands activist leadership, and not just from, you know, BIPOC organizations who've been on the front lines and doing it. You should be demanding that from your elected officials too. That's how I feel.
Well, y'all, I don't have anything to that. First of all, Chicago came out in there. There was a head shake. Let me get y'all together real quick.
Oh my goodness. It drives me crazy.
I know that it drives you crazy because Trust me, like when I have said I would really like to see our elected officials show up in the ways that you just said, there are folks who will then challenge me for saying you shouldn't be asking your elected officials to show up in any kind of way. That means that you are being against the Democratic Party. That means that you are now siding with the other side. And that's not the case. That's not the case. Because at the end of the day, what I think makes it so necessary for us to do that is the fact that we are not the Republican Party. We are not sycophants. We are not cult followers. And the truth is we actually have the intellectual capabilities to know that these elected officials need to show up for us in real ways, not just in verbal ways that make us feel like we just feel good and warm while they take everything that we need out from under us, right? Because so many people who are voting on the Republican block of things don't even realize they're voting against their best interests. They've just fed into this emotional narcissism that has been fed to them that says, you know, if you vote for us, we're going to make all your problems go away. And we're not going to tell you what your problems are other than that they're Black people and Mexicans. Those are your problems. And we're going to make all that go away. They're not. But at the end of the day, I wonder, do you feel that there are, do you feel that there are more people who were questioning or being cynical about that action that you guys took, or that there are more people who are moved by it?
Well, if I only lived on Twitter, I would think there's more people that are cynical. But because I'm, you know, as Representative Tlaib always says, rooted in community, because I'm rooted in community, I believe there are more people who felt a sense of gratitude or a solidarity. You know, I'm glad that they recognize that they're moving with urgency, basically, that they're willing to go out and do anything necessary to have these rights, what was a constitutional right, 50 years, restored, you know? I will say also, it's interesting that they pick and choose who they're critical of regarding that action. So when I was campaigning in St. Louis for Representative Bush, she had opponents who were saying that sleeping on the steps of the Capitol was undignified and unbecoming of a lawmaker, which to me undermines our entire history in the work of civil rights and liberation. Because in fact, Congressman Lewis, may he rest in peace and power.
Thank you.
Rest in peace and
That's
power.
The first image that came to
but,
mind.
But Amanda, most people will make his activism just about the Edmund Pettus Bridge. No, no. He sat on the House floor.
Yes.
Demanding a vote on gun violence. Okay. Now, when we were at the Supreme Court, Barbara Lee was there, my big sister. And, you know, this is a truth teller, and she's an inspiration to many of us. The assistant speaker of the House in my delegation, Catherine Clark, was also there. The chair of the Oversight Committee, Carolyn Maloney, was there. I mean, there were dozens of us that were there. But the ones that were extracted and called out were mostly the women of color. And I think there's something to be said there. You know, why is that action being criticized or downplayed to the significance when we do it, when that is really rooted in the work of our liberation? That's a tradition, that's our history. Whereas when other people do that, it's honorable. They are indefatigable. You know,
indefatigable.
It's, right.
Yes.
They're indefatigable. You know, so, you know, I don't have a lot of spaces to really offer the daily contradictions and double standards and, you know, the gradations that take place, you know, in this. Because if I did that, then someone would say I was sitting in victimhood. Yes. And then I would be gaslit for that. So, you know, the truth of the matter is I don't in any way feel like a victim, but I am going to call out that there is a contradiction. And when we've arrived at a moment where we're under the weight of several layered crises, and we take and do an act of civil disobedience, and there are people who would consider that undignified for a lawmaker, they really do not understand the moment we find ourselves in.
No, they don't. But that's the frustration of so many folks. You know, when I look at the Democratic Party, I think that part of the reason why there continues to be such so many fissures is because at the end of the day, white supremacy is not simply a Republican situation. It's not simply carried out by individuals who are in the Republican Party. There are folks who, whether they want to admit it or not, may identify with Democrat ideals, but still protect their white privilege and still protect their access to white supremacy while trying to be a Democrat. And there's no way to do those two things at the same time as supporting the individuals that are also Democrats who do not have access to white supremacy. So there's always going to be a fissure within this party and an inability for it to move in the effectiveness that the Republican Party can move when that continues to be in the mix. The Republicans move so effortlessly because they're all like, well, we're all white, and those who aren't are fine with the white people running shit, and they'll go along with it. That's it. You know, but when we have folks like you and like AOC and, you know, Representative Bush and Representative Omar, there's never going to be the cohesion that would need to happen to move forward until the people who are moving antithetical to you within your party admit that, or until we vote them out. And that's what I really want to try and like encourage people to do. The voting process is not simply just voting, the same way that you said the legislative process as a elected official is not simply just doing policy. Like, it's a multitude, multi-pronged approach. And I think for so many of us as just citizens, we never really felt like we needed to engage in that multi-pronged approach. We felt like we just kind of maybe only needed to do one little part of it, you know? Even if it's like, I'm going to vote, but I'm only going to vote for the president. Baby, we had primaries. You know, people were so angry about like, well, Biden is our only choice. Well, he wasn't. There were other options. But now we're at this point. You didn't take part in the first parts of this. So that's how we ended up here.
And but I do want to say, Amanda, also, I do believe that given the, now, you know, look, we're coming off of, you know, a victory in that we have passed the Inflation Reduction Act out of the Senate. And Friday, the House will take a vote on that, which has many of the tenants, although not all the things that we originally fought for and Build Back Better, you know, these robust investments that I think are critical to both undoing harm, but also charting a different path forward, because it doesn't matter if people say the pandemic has laid bare and exacerbated every inequity and disparity if we don't want to do anything about it, which is why it bothers me when people say, oh, there's a reckoning on racial injustice. I grew up in a storefront church on the south side of Chicago. This is not a reckoning. There's an awakening. But the reckoning has to be something epic, you know, that's commiserate,
changing.
That's commiserate to the hurt, right? When you are advancing policies that go as deep and as far as the hurt. And so we're
is that really possible within?
Of course, I believe it is possible. Okay. Now, I watch you. I've seen you on Instagram. So I know where you're going on this two-party system thing. And I know you struggle with that, you know, and so I want to hold space for that. But I wanted to say about the primaries and other offices, other office holders on the city and state level, given the obstruction from Senate Republicans, who it seems at many turns had contempt for everyone who calls this country home. The House, we've been doing our job. Like, twice we passed my bill with Judy Chu, the Women's Health Protection Act, and so many other bills that I can name that we moved out of the House only to be met with obstruction in the Senate, right? Including gun reform, right? But we've had state legislatures and mayors and governors and city councilors and school committees who stood in the gap. And at least in Massachusetts, we've had some things advanced, like the Crown Act and, you know, other things that we were unable to get out of the Senate. People have acted on, and including prioritizing reproductive care and access and things like that. So I'm just trying to make your point that every election does matter. Every office holder matters. They're accountable to you. And then the last point that I would make is, I think it's important that as a party and as movement builders, that we never talk down to people. So when I was saying how we have to center their experience, I don't like when we use terminology like low information voters, you know, or like if you or if you just sit in people's struggle, like, I'm going to acknowledge your lived experience, but a poor person does not want to be told they're poor. Right. You know, so it's important that, you know, we also are aspirational. It's important that we listen to people and, again, not talk them out of their experience. People think that people don't vote, Amanda, because they're ignorant or apathetic or don't know any better. People don't vote not because they don't know enough. They don't vote because they know too much.
Facts. Yes.
They know too much. They have a deaf. There's broken hearts, broken promises, a deficit of trust, all these things. So we have to, you can't talk people out of that. You have to like sit in that, take some accountability. I mean, that's how I feel. I feel like, wow, if people are not showing up, I take it personally. I'm like, what have I not done that they don't feel the impact of their government or me in this seat all around them? That they know they need to preserve that advocacy and that partnership. They must not be feeling the impact of my work. I need to go bolder. Or maybe I didn't listen hard enough. I really do take it personally. And maybe I shouldn't, because there is something to be said for personal responsibility and determination and all of that. But I do think we have to not talk people out of their experiences and just acknowledge that that apathy and that cynicism is informed by real experiences with government.
Is there a version of two things existing at the same time, which is having an apathy about the government that has shown up in a repetitive fashion that feels like it's not showing up for you, right? Not you personally, but like for a person.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there a world where that apathy can simultaneously exist with continuing to vote within a system that exists at present? So the reason I say that is I think you know where I'm going with this. The reason I say that is because, like, I think I'm that person. I feel like I am that person. I'm that person who's like, well, I have no proof that this system is effective, because we have continued to fight and fight and fight this system over and over and over and over again. It still continues to have so many gaps. However, until we have a replacement, I still need to have a certain level of effort committed into this space because this is all we have right now.
Absolutely that space exists. Like you said, you occupy it. And I don't think you're alone in that. I mean, again, just like I can acknowledge. So when everyone quotes, Audre Lorde about dismantling the house with the master's tools and, look, I'm in government. I mean, so, I acknowledge the what I'm a part of, by default, because this is how I seek to make a contribution, which is also why it's so damn hard, So I do think that, that space certainly exists and many people occupy that space. The other thing,
and you'll be radical in that space without completely removing yourself from that space, is there a version of that? I think you're the closest version.
Yeah. And, look, I define radical the way Angela Y. Davis does, which to address things from the root. I think many people define radical as something, very different. I'm really just talking about like deep systemic change, undoing centuries of harm. I do think it's possible, but again, change ultimately, that's why Coretta Scott King said freedom is won, it's earned every generation. We don't have it in perpetuity. Like, you know that, because you can't have a people emancipated from enslavement go through Reconstruction, have it all undone by Jim Crow. You can't have a settled constitutional law in the books for 50 years and then have the Supreme Court legislate from the bench and undo it like that and not know that gains are not guarantees. Like, we have to fight like hell to preserve the gains we have and build upon them. So I just say all that to say that if you know that that's what the work is, then I know that progress is not going to be measured in weeks and days. It will be measured in decades. It will be measured in years. Like, in many ways, the reason why this work is hard, Amanda, is because you're sort of being a better ancestor than you are descendant.
Yes.
Because when you're really seeking to, you don't know that these things are going. There are things that we do, like community project funding and earmarks and things like that, physically all around us, you can point to as some signal of progress and as a manifestation of your work, right? But for the most part, when you're talking about, like, I served on the city council 8 years. I wanted to serve on the federal level because every inequity, every disparity, every racial injustice was legislated. This is not like, shit in the ether. Okay. It was legislated, codified in laws, codified in budgets. And most of the residual fallout of that stuff that we see in cities and states and existing for generations started with federal policy. So that's why I wanted to serve on the federal level. So if I know that that's my, if I know that's my assignment, sis, I have to be realistic about that time frame. So I got to move with, I was talking to my sisters the other day and we were just saying that someone has said you're impatient, and we just arrived at this like, well, listen, my sister said, well, patience is a methodology of the privileged. We're moving with urgency and boldness because we know lives depend on it.
Yes.
When we're looking at a prospect of forced birth and Black women are 3 times more likely to die in childbirth. After our ancestors have already endured, and Indigenous women, medical apartheid, forced sterilization, medical experimentation, all these things, so this is life and death. I have to move with boldness. I have to move with urgency, but I'm also couching it in the timetable of the work of justice. Like, it's like I'm believing that we can bring about a change. I'm working for it to happen urgently because I need it to. But I also know that even if I'm successful in that, we won't be done. you know, because we won't be. That's what it is. That's the algorithm. Like, Amanda, when people keep saying the moment we're in is unprecedented, that is a falsehood. It's unprecedented in our lifetime.
Yeah.
But it's not unprecedented. No. So like, this is the algorithm of the world. This is the algorithm of the work of justice. So just like, what do you want to do for your time here?
I mean, so is that really just it, sis? Like, are we just, is that where the, I guess, the peace within comes from in terms of committing to, because, you know, we're quoting folks. So, you know, Baldwin's like, any Black person with any level of, I'm paraphrasing, with any level rage. Of awareness is living in rage, right?
Right.
I think so much of our rage comes from the feeling of, why is there advancement and then regression and advancement and regression? I think for a lot of us, it feels like, why haven't we learned a way to,
I got you. Yeah. Like, what's the combination, you know, like, tell me the combination, at least,
like, extend, you know, or at least to like diminish, you know, it's like when you get in a relationship and you start seeing like, oh, our arguments are happening farther apart now. Look, we're learning each other. Like, we figured out each other. I feel like so much of my frustration and the peers that I speak to, and just, you know, the people in my group of supporters feel like we're like never learning the algorithm, but the opposition has mastered it.
Yeah.
And it's like,
that's what? Real.
It's like,
that's real.
But then you say to yourself, to your point, you say to yourself like, well, until we do, this is the work I have to do. And, you know, Angela Y. Davis did say, she was like, I saw an interview she did where somebody was asking her, you know, what's the point of protesting at this point? What's the point? What's the point of protesting? You were protesting, we're protesting. What's the point? And she said, because you're continuing to chip away. You're continuing to chip away. You can't just stop, because once you stop, then they continue to keep going and they're pulling you along with them. At least when you are in action, you are opposing the quickness with which they can take you down this road.
Think that people have to take stock of the victories. Like, look at the unionization, you know, what's happening, you know, with Amazon, Starbucks.
Shout out to Chris Moss.
You know, it's right, exactly. Ooh, it's a bad, anyway, you know, you know, right? I don't know if you saw his testimony before the Senate, but anyway, you know, look at what's happening throughout the country. That is a signal of progress. That 1,000%. Is a testament to the movement. The fact that, and I led this fight in the House, that we were able to get a pause on student loan payments 3 times during the pandemic, and we're closer than ever to getting cancellation, that is a testament and a credit to the movement. The fact that I sit in this seat, which it took 230 years in progressive Massachusetts to elect the first person of color to our delegation. You know, I can't pretend that that's not a signal of some progress. Do I wish that we had leadership parity in race and gender and much earlier? Do I think everyone stands to benefit from that? You know, absolutely, because we call different questions. You know, we bring a different perspective. We move differently, right? I mean, hell, how I show up in the world as a bald Black woman is disruptive, you know, all on its own, the space that I'm occupying and that representation. Shout out to the 7 million people out there living with alopecia. But, you know, so I agree, you know, with what you offered there. I just want us to also take credit for the victories, because I think like the dominant, they want you to feel like we're always losing. You know, we're not. We're about to send to Congress Summer Lee out of Pennsylvania, Delia Ramirez out of Illinois, Greg Cesar out of Texas, you know, this.
But do you know why people feel that way? Because people don't feel safe. Because even if we have these victories, people don't feel safe. People don't feel safe in or secure that those victories are going to be the goals and the gains that we need. And that's really where people are right now. And I can say that because I do my best to be that objective person. And we know that we need to identify those victories, because baby, we got to fight the power and fight for our joy in the same voice.
Thank you for saying that. Amanda, we have got to figure this part out, because I'm going to tell you something. My mother, may she rest in peace and power. I feel like she equipped me with, and she was a Sagittarius, so she was very joyful. Okay. But, and very conscious, but she equipped me with so much armor. Like, baby girl, this is what you need to navigate hostile territory. This is what you need to negotiate these rooms. Everything was about armor. And I feel like our whole identity has become that of like the resistance and warriors. So we'll erase our own humanity. The reason why people can do centuries of legislated harm against Black folks or the marginalized people is because they don't see our humanity. So those of us doing this work, we can't allow that to happen too. Like, we gotta be as radical and bold in the work of resistance, and just as radical in our joy and our healing. And that's the space that I'm trying to figure out now.
Like, I can tell you now. I can tell you one thing right now.
Okay, tell me.
Because you already said it. The canvassing is radical, and I'm gonna tell you why. Because analog connections at this point are radical, because they require a level of energy that a lot of people aren't afraid to put in. They require a level of connection that a lot of people are afraid to do, but that is necessary, because that human connection is more powerful than any Wi-Fi connection. And so many on the other side are getting away with doing things digital. And the truth is that we are not doing enough person to person to really crack through in the way that this digital shit is just succumbing everyone's life. That to me is the actual radical way of connecting. Like, when you said that earlier, I was like, oh, that brings me a sense of awareness. I mean, of relief, because I'm like, okay, they're seeing that. There's so much that has to be emotionally done for folks to fight the way they need to fight. So that's why I'm with you when we say, like, we do have to acknowledge our victories, because they do bring us a certain level of like, okay, like seeing Kansas, I was like, okay.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, White women decided to vote for their best interests and not just for their husband's best interests. But I want to just ask you, when it does come to abortion, you know, I think a lot of folks are definitely trying to get to the root of what is this really about? Like, what is the actual reason that abortion rights were repealed in this country? Because there's so many versions of why, right? There's this idea that it's, oh, there's a birth dearth of white people. Oh, there's a Christian nationalist, you know, ideal that abortion is against God's wishes, et cetera. You know, then there's folks who say this is just it's somewhat euphemistic that they're using to gain power from people that in constituencies that they know can support the Republican vote. What would you say is the real reason why there was a push successfully to repeal abortion rights in this country, same shit.
I wish I had some poetic response, honestly, because I could. I mean,
why? Like, yeah, of all the things,
well, first of all, it's coordinated. Okay, so let me just say this. It's layered and it's coordinated, okay? So I chair the Abortion Rights and Access Task Force under the Pro-Choice Caucus. This is the first pro-choice majority Congress in the history of Congress. And that's a role that I'm very appreciative to be able to play, especially at this moment. And recently, I hosted Vice President Harris in my district, and this was a big part of the strategy discussion we had on how to replicate what happened in Kansas, you know, while still pushing for all these other things. And again, you know, HHS and the president have rolled out new guidance and executive actions that are responsive to our movement, which is saying you have to protect providers and patients from criminalization. You have to preserve and expand access to medication abortion. The House not only passed the Women's Health Protection Act twice, which would enshrine Roe, but we also passed legislation for the right to travel for those who are in those triggered law states so that they can go to safe havens like the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to get the abortion care that they need. And I could go on that front. But if you look at the states that have trigger laws and there is not abortion care since Roe has been struck down by the Supreme Court, these are the same states advancing in their state legislatures anti-LGBTQ, you know, transphobic legislation. These are the same states that are the most active when it comes to voter suppression, you know, purging the rolls and all those different things. So there's nothing coincidental about the fact that you have those three concentric circles of voting rights, abortion care, reproductive access, LGBTQ, you know, all of those things are happening. It is a coordinated, legislated oppression. That's it. Now, do we
But why?
It's in
they just don't like
to, I think it's in response to our growing power, you know, electorally and otherwise. Yeah. And, you know, if you were going to take it, you know, take it back to my granddaddy's storefront church, I would say, you know, that those that are last will be first and, you know, all that kind of thing. It's like the most marginalized, right, have mobilized and that has resulted in new power. I don't think we always know
that's the word there.
I don't think we always know how powerful we are.
Yeah.
And I don't think we include everyone in this new power narrative. One pet peeve of mine and something I'm really focused on right now, and thank you for lifting up our deep canvassing. We also do wellness calls. Just literally, we just call seniors and say, how are you? You know, what do you need? Make sure that they know what resources are available for them that they might not. But the other thing I'm squarely focused on is Black men, because I think that we have erased them from the narrative, okay? We're either only, in other words, we only say Black women are the defenders of democracy and of this Democratic Party. And that's not true as Black people. Black women have always voted at higher rates.
Yeah.
And we are playing an outsized role at the ballot box and on the ballot, giving the unprecedented number of Black women running for office at every level. But right. Make no mistake about it, Black men have been the defenders of democracy in this party as well. And we don't always include them in the narrative. And so when Black men hear Donald Trump in his closing arguments say, what do you have to lose? And we're not communicating to them directly, they're like,
What do I have to lose?
Right. And the other thing, again, as I said, if you're poor, you don't want someone telling you you're poor. You know, I think elected officials on both sides, but it's something I've worked to really change within our own party, will single issue a constituency. So they will like go to Black folks and only talk about mass incarceration. And yeah. We're like, we're so glad that, you know, you give a damn about that right now. But I also care about Black home ownership,
yep.
You know, access, not just to healthcare,
student loans.
Access to quality healthcare. I care about student loans. I, you know, all these other, you know, again, none of us live in one box. We live in intersectionality. So they'll go to Black folks, talk about mass incarceration, but they won't speak to like Black opportunity, aspiration, wealth building. They'll go to the Latino community. And by the way, immigration is not just a Hispanic Latino issue.
No, the in biggest number of immigrant deportation is Black folks.
Black immigrants, right, disproportionately impacted, which is why I co-chair the Haiti caucus, because I represent the third largest Haitian diaspora in the country, fought to get Title 42 repealed, you know, but now that's caught up in the courts, you know, and that kind of thing. But it's like there's Black immigrants. There's
What is Title 42? Just real quick.
Oh, OK. So that is that was a policy weaponized under Trump that allows you to deport people in the name of public health. So right. When you saw, you know, Haitian migrants being whipped at the southern border, that was all mm-hmm. under the umbrella mm-hmm. of Title 42. And so these unjust deportations, even after the Biden administration came in and did a 100-day moratorium on deportations, they continued. You know, ICE and CBP continued to do their work, and that burden was disproportionately borne by Black immigrants, especially Haitian. Immigrants.
Right. Do you want to take a moment to celebrate the fact that they have now successfully repealed the stay in Mexico law? Like, wasn't that
Yes, that's true too. I mean, come on. You know, listen, you know this stuff. You're not a fake about, you know, you're a voracious reader. You stay
I have
up
people
on this
that
stuff.
Are listening.
You know, so
let me just tell you.
Yeah.
I only got up on this stuff in the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. I have, by nature of just like a bigger force pushing me, it's mm-hmm. not fun to be up on this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not peaceful. It's not soul fulfilling to be up on this stuff. It's actually soul killing. And that's why, you know, the victories require so much attention. But I know that the people listening to my show, they also, I'm up on this stuff also because like it feeds my work. So it makes, it's easy.
If people, but also you're making it accessible and digestible.
That's my point. That's why
people,
I said it.
I didn't say to people as well. I thank you.
People are working. They don't got time to know who Mueller and all these people are. They're like Buttigieg, Buttigieg. They got to feed my kid.
Trying to survive. Yeah.
I read that and I was like, oh, something good.
That's true. But that's what I'm saying. So there are some victories along the way. But my longer, you know, point here is that, we single issue constituencies, and that does a disservice in every way to movement building, to telling the story of the impact of the victories that we have had, because you're like, okay, LGBTQ folks, we used to think they cared about marriage equality. We took care of that. So they're probably all set. Or maybe we could talk a little bit about like public accommodation for trans individuals, but like, we're good. You know, if we speak to Hispanic and Latinos and say we're for immigration reform, they're good. Even though like South Asians experience unjust deportation, separation of family, Black immigrants, you know, all of that. And with women, and that as long as we say we're pro-choice and we support reproductive, you know, justice, then, you know, they're going to be all good.
Which
and
they don't say intersectionality.
And they don't say nothing to the AAPI community. I mean, I tell my friends in the AAPI community, I'm like, y'all are not even the model minority. You're the invisible one. I mean, wow. No one, but what has happened with the AAPI community, and also this is true for Black men, is that in many of these states that are up for, you know, grabs that we really need to keep or that we hope that we pick up, they are becoming the margin of victory. The AAPI community in Atlanta, in Georgia, we saw that. As Georgia became more purple, the AAPI community was really impactful in that. And I would say in the states that we have carried, it's not just Black women, you know, so Black men have been a part of that. And where you really see it play out, Amanda, is in those primaries. When you look at primaries and you look at that vote and where it's coming from, Black men are a part of that as well. So we need to, you know,
Big them up.
You know,
well, this is my last question before I let you go, because I know you got work to do.
Yeah.
What are people, why is it so important that people come out in these midterm elections? Like, I think that things become buzzwords out here, right? It's like, you gotta vote in the midterm, gotta vote, go. But why actually? What is at stake? And what is the actual impetus and intention that we need to be heading to the polls with?
Well, I mean, everything is under attack. Our civil rights, you know, the survivability and our livability, like here on this planet, you know, legislative victories that have been, you know, our rights that we've been entitled to and had access to for decades, you know, everything is under attack, including our peace of mind, which is why I understand why people are so fatigued and so weary, you know. But when I say that it's life or death, it is. Like, I know that abortion care is health care, that if we do not see more states affirming abortion care as a fundamental right, if we do not see Roe eventually overturned, if we don't see integrity and balance restored to the Supreme Court, that is a matter, like, people will die. Right. If we do not, like we're doing with the Inflation Reduction Act, make these robust investments in climate, we will not have a planet. So all of these things are, everything you care about, everything you need is on the ballot. And you should vote your interest. If you care about student debt cancellation, you know, what side do you think is, you know, is focused on that? And then I would just say on the movement.
Can I just say side note, guys, while you're listening, just because someone is a Democrat doesn't mean that they are also, they're supporting all of your best interests. You need to take the time to individually look at each candidate and what they stand for. Like, I saw a Democrat today who said they were against student loan expunging. And I was like, wait, what? I thought we all agreed.
Yeah, no, definitely not. I mean, again, there's, you know, there's gradations there. So you're right. And that it's hard for voters to be informed and do their homework, because again, people are just trying to like survive and make it by, and they're just so overwhelmed. But you have to do it. Like, people are making decisions about your survivability. They're making decisions every day about whether you live or die.
Yes.
And so you should vote. But also, I think if you don't vote, and I'll just say this particularly for the progressive movement, that people get to say that victories like mine and Representative Bush and Tlaib and Pramila Jayapal and, you know, Katie Porter and others that I can, Representative Ocasio-Cortez, that these are flukes, that they're outliers.
Yeah.
You know, that people don't want bold, transformative, systemic change, that they are actually content with the status quo. This is just, you know, an unruly insurgency of a few who subscribe to this worldview and who want to see this change. So we need the mandate. We need the mandate that we are not anomalies. We are not flukes. That we are extensions of a growing multiracial, multigenerational movement that wants to see bold, transformative, generational change. And that does mean disrupting the status quo. That does mean disrupting and dismantling white supremacy. That does mean governing differently. It means organizing differently. It means the work of liberation. It means instead of mass oppression, mass liberation, instead of treating trauma with trauma, that we create ecosystems that support and promote healing. I think another world is possible, you know, where we do choose people over profit, but we have to stay in it. And so if you believe like me that another world is possible, if you keep that stakehold in your democracy and let them know that those few of us who may be close to your worldview, that we're not flukes, that there is a paradigm shift occurring.
You're not flukes. You're a new precedent. And I think that's that to me, as any help that I can be in helping to push that paradigm shift, I will be. So please consider me a resource. We are so happy to have you here. We are also very happy to acknowledge that you have a cat.
Yeah. You want me to go get her?
Yes, okay. Please. Oh,
okay,
God.
Hold on.
Okay. She's a shit. I saw a cat. Now, y'all know that if there's ever a cat anywhere within eyesight of me, I'm going to find that cat. I'm like, is there a cat? I think I just saw a cat. Okay.
All right. You have to be body positive, though.
Hello. Hello, who is this?
Hold on. Okay.
Who is this?
Okay, so this is Sojourner Truth, Presley Harris.
Yes.
But we call her Sojo. Look at her little white
paw. Hi, Sojo.
She's a Mancoon, you know, and she's just the sweetest, cuddliest little thing.
Is.
But of course, we have the name of Sojourner Truth because everybody does the work of abolition, you know, and liberation in this house. My husband rescued her and he said, look at her white feet. Can't we just call her socks? He said, everything has to be so deep with you. But now he loves it. And she's like most cats. She likes Zoom. You know,
hello.
So, yeah.
Hi, Sojourner. Hey, Sojo.
It's
I am woman. Yes. Well, thank you, Sojo. Thank you, Representative Presley. We appreciate you. And let me just tell you something. I know that you are somebody who speaks ardently about the alopecia community, and you are a member of that community. And we honor you for showing up every day as your whole self. All right. Giving us all the flavor. Giving us all the flavor. But I meant what I said, and any help I can be in continuing to, you know, speak the message that you guys are actually living within our current government space in a way that can encourage people to have their own power and use that power, I will be a vessel in that respect. So let me know.
Well, and I'm happy to lock arms with you, sis. I appreciate your consciousness. I appreciate, again, the responsible way with which you steward your platform. Thank you for creating the space and the opportunity. Thank you for your solidarity. And, you know, just I just appreciate how you continue to be you fully and unapologetically. And I especially love all the takes on your prior life as a talk show host. Those are, you know.
Well, thank you also for your vocabulary, because I got some words that I have to look up, and that is rare.
Okay.
That is
okay.
It.
You say so.
Right. I am there. Okay. All right. Enjoy the rest of your day. Shout
Thank
out to
you.
Sojo.
You too. All right. Look at her. She's ready to go. Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Star Bands Avenue, a podcast network.